Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, Creation and Evolution, Part 15. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go online to reasonablefaith.org.
Last time in class, we talked about the compatibility of evolutionary theory with Christian theism. And I argued that, in fact, evolutionary theorists, when you press them for what the theory holds technically, does not hold that life or biological complexity on this planet originated by chance. Rather, randomness in the theory simply means that the mutations occur without a view toward the benefit of the organism in which they occur, so that the theory is entirely compatible with God's having a purpose or a direction or even causal influence upon the evolutionary process. Now, this raises a related question. Many scientists and philosophers would argue that science, by its very nature, is committed to a sort of methodological naturalism, not a metaphysical naturalism according to which supernatural entities do not exist, but simply a methodological form of naturalism. That is to say, science seeks only natural causes of the phenomena in the world. It's part of the methodology of science to simply look for natural causes of the phenomena that it investigates. And therefore, supernatural explanations of phenomena would simply be methodologically excluded from the pool of live explanatory options. So, if we had a body of empirical data to be explained, the natural scientist will assemble a pool of live explanatory options to choose from. And methodologically, he will include in this pool of live explanatory options only hypotheses that are appealing to purely natural causes. That's not to say that there are not non-natural or supernatural entities that exist that might provide other sorts of explanations, but simply that methodologically, these don't enter into the project of science. The project of science is to find the best natural explanation of the phenomena that it seeks to explain. And so these supernaturalistic hypotheses wouldn't even come into consideration. They're not even in the pool of live explanatory options. And this would hold for the Christian scientist as well. The Christian scientist must be methodologically restricted to naturalistic explanations. Now, what's striking about methodological naturalism is that it is a philosophical and not a scientific viewpoint. This is not an issue to which scientific evidence is relevant. Rather, it is about the philosophy of science. It's about the limits of science and the nature of the project of science and what science is restricted to. And so this is not something that is susceptible to scientific proof or disproof. It is a philosophical question about the nature of science as such. And as a philosophical question, it's extremely difficult to justify methodological naturalism. As William Dembski has pointed out, adopting methodological naturalism would prevent your inferring design of the universe, even if every atom in the universe were inscribed with the label "made by God" on it, which would seem preposterous. More seriously, suppose that life and biological complexity really were the result of creative, miraculous interventions, at various points in the past. Suppose we really do live in a universe like that, where God has miraculously intervened in the evolutionary process to bring about life forms that would not have otherwise evolved. It would be a tragedy, don't you think, if we were prevented from discovering the truth about reality simply because of a methodological constraint that we have adopted. This would be, I think, a tragedy not only personally, but scientifically as well. We would be prevented from really knowing the truth about how life and biological complexity came about simply because of this methodological constraint that we've adopted. Methodology is supposed to be an aid to helping you discover the truth about reality, not to be a hindrance keeping you from discovering the truth about reality. But let's leave that point aside. The more important point that I want to make is that we are not now, in this context, concerned with what a scientist, as a scientist, might infer as the best explanation of biological complexity. That's not the question that we're raising in this class, what a scientist, as a scientist, is at liberty to infer about the best explanation of biological complexity. Rather, our question that we're exploring is, how, from a theological point of view, should we integrate what the Bible teaches with what the best scientific evidence indicates? We're not trying to justify an inference to design. Rather, we are taking a theological standpoint, beginning with what the Bible teaches, and we're trying to integrate our theology with the empirical evidence. So even if it's true that the scientist can only work within the constraints of methodological naturalism, that doesn't affect in any way the systematic theologian. The systematic theologian is quite at liberty to adopt non-naturalistic views of the world if those help to integrate theology and science in a more harmonious way. So, it seems to me that the systematic theologian who approaches this question could admit freely that, say, the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution is, in fact, the best naturalistic hypothesis for explaining biological complexity. He could say that of the naturalistic options available, the neo-Darwinian theory is by far the best naturalistic theory we've got. If, as a result of methodological naturalism, we are constrained to looking only at naturalistic hypotheses, then, until recently at least, it does seem that the neo-Darwinian theory of biological evolution, which explains evolutionary development in terms of random mutation and natural selection, is in fact the best naturalistic theory. Indeed, really, as we've said the other day, it's the only game in town, pretty much. The rival naturalistic hypotheses cannot equal the explanatory power, the explanatory scope, the plausibility of the neo-Darwinian hypothesis. And so one could agree that the best naturalistic account is the neo-Darwinian theory. No matter how improbable it seems relative to the evidence, no matter how enormously far its explanatory mechanisms need to be extrapolated beyond the testable evidence, no matter the lack of evidence for many of its key tenets, nevertheless, it's still the best naturalistic explanation compared to its rivals, because there isn't any other naturalistic explanation that comes close to the standard theory in terms of its explanatory virtues. So, Philip Johnson, for example, has often said that he would have no objection at all to evolutionary theorists saying that neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory is the best naturalistic explanation we have of biological complexity. He has no objection to a claim like that at all. But of the pool of live explanatory naturalistic options, the neo-Darwinian theory is the best. But what Johnson objects to is saying that the neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory is the best explanation, period. When you consider the non-naturalistic explanations, Johnson would contend that if you were to include them in the pool of live explanatory options, then it would no longer be obvious that the best explanatory option is the neo-Darwinian theory. He would say then some of these supernaturalistic hypotheses may well be better. So what we're going to do in this class is we're going to approach this question from a theological point of view. And we're going to ask how, given the biblical data and the scientific evidence, should we best understand the origin of life and the origin of biological complexity? And as we approach these questions, I want to emphasize that I am not a professional biologist. Rather, I am a theologian with a layman's interest in these scientific questions. So I do not speak with expertise on these biological questions, but like you, have a layman's interest in them and want to do the best job I can of synthesizing my theology with what the best scientific evidence today indicates. So any discussion on this point about methodological naturalism and how it shapes one's inquiry. Yes, Bob.
Basically, you're talking about evidences, and you use that term of evidence. But is it not also possible, and we have a variety of scientists in this room, realizing that there can be a bias in the collection of evidence and the presentation of evidence. And if we as philosophers, as philosophers looking at this, there's sort of an assumption there that the evidence that is being accepted is being true evidence, properly presented. And so I'm not saying it's not all true, that what percentage is, we don't know, but that caveat maybe should be understood from the very beginning that not all evidence is really true evidence. Yeah. It's biased by the collector.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair comment, Bob. And it is true that sometimes people who are scientific mavericks get excluded from the mainstream discussion because they disagree and they look at anomalous data that doesn't fit. But I must say, in all honesty, I think one of the wonderful things about science is its self-correcting nature. It is true that these kinds of things happen, but what you find, I think, is over a generation or so, the anomalies surface and come back, and subsequent scientists come to see the biases and the prejudices maybe that blinded earlier thinkers, and that evidence has to be freshly dealt with again. And so these anomalies, I don't think, can be suppressed forever. Science really does have a wonderful kind of self-correcting feature to it that makes it hard for the evidence to be perpetually twisted and distorted in such a way that it can't be seen correctly. But certainly those who are going against, say, a mainstream view will need to exhibit courage and tenacity in demanding that their data be looked at and that that the scientific paradigm, the mainstream view, look honestly at this anomalous data that they're presenting. I think that's right. Yes, David.
I'd be curious how you would respond to one of the most common defenses of scientific naturalism, which is that it seems to work. You'll often hear people comment, physics and chemistry have been so successful in describing the world around us that scientific naturalism must be the right way to go because it's been successful.
Now, this is exactly the defense that Alex Rosenberg, whom I'm going to be debating at Purdue, takes in justification of what he calls scientism, or, as David put it, naturalism, or scientific naturalism. Now, what I want to say about this, David, is that this term covers a diversity of viewpoints that need to be carefully distinguished if we're not to be misled. First, there's what we can call epistemological naturalism. What's that? Well, epistemological naturalism says that we should only believe what can be scientifically proven, that science is our only source of knowledge and truth. That's epistemological naturalism. Science is our only source of knowledge and truth. Metaphysical naturalism, on the other hand, is the view that only physical things exist, that there are no supernatural realities like spirits, souls, God, and so forth. So we have epistemological naturalism, which says that science is the only source of knowledge and truth, and metaphysical naturalism, which says that only physical things exist, there are no supernatural entities. Now, with regard to epistemological naturalism, the justification would be the success of natural science in giving us truth about the world, that it has been enormously successful in telling us what the physical world is like. And what I would say to that is that that goes no distance whatsoever in showing that science is the only source of knowledge and truth. What it does is show that natural science is the best way of discovering truth about the physical world. It is what will give us knowledge of the physical world. But to say that, therefore, there are no ethical truths, there are no aesthetic truths, there are no mathematical or logical truths, there are no metaphysical truths, like that the past has existed longer than 5 minutes, or that the external world is real, it would be, I think, an overly restrictive theory of truth and knowledge. We can know things even though they can't be scientifically proven. And indeed, this kind of epistemological naturalism would actually undermine science itself, because science is itself permeated by assumptions that cannot be scientifically proven. So that if you adopt this view, it would, in fact, undermine the very project of science. So what we, I think, want to say is that the incredible, amazing track record of empirical science simply shows that science is the best tool for knowledge and truth about the physical universe. But it doesn't imply that there are other types of truth. The philosopher Ed Fezzer gives a wonderful analogy. He says, imagine that you have a metal detector which is so calibrated that it will detect anything metal. It is so infallible that it is the best metal detector you could find. He says, would that prove that there are no non-metallic objects? That this is the only thing that exists, are metallic things? Well, obviously not. And that's exactly the same error that the epistemological naturalist is making. Because his metal detector, so to speak, is so good, so efficient at discovering empirical physical truth, he concludes there is no other kind of truth, and that there is no other source of knowledge. And that is as silly as the person who thinks the metal detector would show there are no non-metallic objects or no truths about them. So that would be epistemological naturalism. I would also say that epistemological naturalism is self-defeating, because the statement, science is the only source of knowledge, is something that cannot be scientifically proven. That's a philosophical statement. So that if you only believe what science can prove, you wouldn't believe that statement. So that epistemological naturalism is really self-refuting. Now, what I want to say in addition to that is that with respect to metaphysical naturalism, even if you were an epistemological naturalist, that doesn't imply metaphysical naturalism, because I think you can have arguments that appeal to modern science for positing non-physical realities. And a paradigm example of this was the Harvard philosopher W.V. O'Quine, who was the most famous epistemological naturalist of the 20th century. Quine said we should only believe what the natural sciences discover and teach us. Nevertheless, Quine showed himself remarkably and commendably open to the existence of non-physical, immaterial entities. He said, if you could show me the indirect explanatory benefit of soul, of a creator, he said, I would joyfully accord to them scientific status along with quarks and black holes. And as you know, many of the arguments that I use for God's existence, like the arguments from the origin of the universe and the fine-tuning of the universe, precisely follow Quine's prescription. They tried to show the explanatory benefit of theism with regard to scientifically established facts like the origin and fine-tuning of the universe. And in fact, Quine himself actually did believe in the existence of non-physical immaterial entities. In particular, he thought that modern science requires us to believe in the existence of mathematical objects, like sets, and that these must also be part of our view of what actually exists. So that Quine himself was not a metaphysical naturalist. In that sense, he believed that in addition to physical entities, there are these non-physical mathematical entities like sets. So that's how I would respond to the person who attempts to show on the basis of scientism that belief in God is not reasonable. So that's a little précis of what I'm going to say in this debate. Yes, Bruce?
Well, you touched on this, but aren't both of these forms of naturalism contradictory? Because if you're totally a naturalist, you have any form of knowledge you say you compile from the natural world is illusory. You have no guarantee that what happened years ago or today will happen in the next 30 seconds.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bruce. As I said, I think epistemological naturalism is self-defeating in the way I explained, but I also think metaphysical naturalism is ultimately self-defeating, because I think Rosenberg is right that in a world of only physical entities, there would not be what philosophers call intentional states. Now, what does that mean, you ask? Well, intentional states are states that are have intentionality, or the property of being about something or of something. It signifies the object-directedness of our thoughts. I can think about my summer vacation, or I can think of my wife. So my conscious states, my thoughts, have this sort of intentionality to them. They have this object-directedness. They're about something. They are thoughts of something. Now, think about this, Bruce. No physical object has intentionality. A chair isn't about something. A stone isn't about something. A glob of tissue, like the brain sitting in your skull, isn't about something. Intentionality is a feature of consciousness, of mental states. So in a world in which only physical things exist, only physical objects, there wouldn't be any intentional states. There wouldn't be any thoughts about anything. And in that respect, I think Rosenberg is right. But then it just seems to me to follow clearly that metaphysical naturalism is false, because I can think about metaphysical naturalism, right? I have thoughts about metaphysical naturalism, whether it's true or false. So that the very fact that I can think about this theory shows that the theory is false, because on the theory there would be no intentional states. So I think you're absolutely right. Both of these ultimately reduce to self-refutation and absurdity. Drew?
All right, thanks. That's intentionality with a T as opposed to an S, right?
Yes, that's right,
right.
With a T.
So the aboutness, I was wondering, have metaphysical naturalists, I assume they have, they've tried to reduce aboutness to a physical state of affairs, right? I mean, it seems like if you can't deduce it.
I think some would say that aboutness can be explained simply in terms of behavior or function, that to have a thought about something is to behave in a certain way. A kind of behaviorist view, but that's obviously, I think, incorrect. When I think about something, it's nothing to do with my behavior. It's the object directedness of my thoughts.
And so there's pretty good support, though, that it's irreducible. Intentionality, even among many philosophers of the mind, is pretty much irreducible.
I mean, obviously, there are proponents of every view. I mean, look at Rosenberg. He thinks that you don't exist. So everything is controverted. But I would say that the view that intentional states are not something that is characteristic of a physical object is pretty solid, and that therefore they require some sort of mental states. And the question will be whether or not the naturalist can make room for mental states in his view. Rosenberg thinks not, and therefore he says they're illusory.
And supervenience is different than reducibility, right?
Right. Okay, Bo has a question. I didn't expect to be talking about these things today, but
so interesting.
Just as well, they've been on my mind. I have a mind. I think I do.
Would you say that methodological naturalism denies agent causation altogether? Not just that there would be maybe a
Bo, that metaphysical naturalism would deny agent causation because there isn't any intentionality if they're just brain states and there are no mental states.
Correct.
But epistemological naturalism, or you said
methodological. Correct.
That has to deny these other things. It could admit that there are these non-natural entities and theories and truths about them. But I, as a scientist, just can't consider them. So you have to understand how weak methodological naturalism is. I think a great many Christian scientists would accept it. They would say, and I've heard them say, when I go into the laboratory and put on my white coat, I have to only consider what would naturally explain what's going on in this lab experiment, that the scientist, the project of science is just to find natural causes. That doesn't mean there aren't any non-natural causes, but I, as a scientist, just am not looking for them. So methodological naturalism, I think, is very, very weak, and would be completely consistent with saying there's agents who have causal effects upon things, but you wouldn't be able to appeal to them in your physical theory. You would just be able to talk about the brain.
Yeah, which seems to be the problem, because if you deny, even if you just say, I can't really talk, while there might be agents, I can only recognize in my data event causation, isn't the scientist acting as an agent to bring a set of circumstances about in which an experiment is conducted, and therefore really undermining the whole project altogether? I mean,
well, now, except think about it, the methodological naturalist isn't offering a theory about what he himself is doing. So you might be right that it would imply the reality of agents, but he's not denying that, and he's not offering a theory about that. So the neurobiologist, say, or the neurosurgeon, can offer theories about the brain and why these neurons fire and so forth, even if that requires a self-conscious agent to carry out those physical, sure, biological experiments. And I don't think that that's self-defeating. That would just be to say that this neuroscientist is adopting a very limited project, just like the man with the metal detector is looking for metallic objects, and he's not looking for wooden objects or plastic objects. Any other question about this point? All right, so to recap then, I'm not persuaded that the scientist needs to be committed to methodological naturalism. As I say, it could lead to very odd situations where we'd be prevented from knowing the truth about the world simply because of our methodology, which seems perverse. But in any case, that's not our project in this class. What we want to do is look at things from a theological standpoint and ask, how can we as Christian theologians best integrate our theology and the best evidence of contemporary science concerning the origin of life and biological complexity? With that said, what we will do when we meet next time will be to open the question of the origin of life. How did life come about on this planet? How is this best understood from a Christian point of view? That will be the question that we'll begin to explore next time.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.